Hi everyone, this is Amira Adawi, your host of Beauty and Wellness Talk podcast. This podcast is intended to raise awareness on the issues of colorism, skin lining practices, and chemical exposures that predominantly impact communities of color. This platform is also to empower women to own their own identity, learn about their own identity, and own their own God-given beauty. So today my guest is Lynn Thomas, who is a professor of history at the University of Washington. And Lynn have done extensive research on skin lighting practices in South Africa and some other countries in Africa. And so she recently wrote a book called Beneath the Services, A Transnational History of Skin Lighting. And so I am excited of interviewing today Lynn and discuss with her about her research and about her book. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to Beauty and Wellness Talk. I am so glad to have you today and talk to you about your work on skin lighting practices in South Africa and other parts of Africa that you have been focusing on for many, many, many years. So welcome.
Thank you so much. It is such a pleasure and an honor to be here with you, Amira. I am such an admirer of your work and Beauty Well's work.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Lynn. So so to start with, could you tell me how did you get into this extensive research? I know you are a historian. Could you talk about brief history of yourself? How did you get into this research and thinking of producing this important knowledge around this issue that impacts predominantly communities of color, and it's just very toxic practice?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a white American woman, and my dad was in the Air Force. So we kind of grew up, I grew up around the US and actually lived in Germany as a child as well. Mm-hmm. And growing up, I really had never heard of skin lighteners. But then I went to university and I studied African history. And so the first time I went anywhere in Africa was in 1989. I went to Kenya and I was doing a research project that was about customary law. So a topic not really related to skin lighteners. But while I was there, I saw in 1989 and 90 how skin lightening products were sold and advertised in Kenya. And that you could kind of see them everywhere, really. And I was really surprised by that. And I was surprised by that because studying African history at university, you know, I had read the work of people like Jomo Kenyatta or Frantz Fanon, these African men who really talked about how important African practices were and really, you know, embraced a kind of patriotic and prideful nationalism. So it surprised me to see these advertisements in that. So that kind of stuck in my head. And then I went on and I did research on other things for about 10 years. And then once I started my job here at the University of Washington, some colleagues who worked on other parts of the world, so they were also historians of gender, but they worked on China and India and Germany and the US. Together, we decided to try to write a history of what we call the modern girl. So the modern girl being this figure who emerges in the 1920s and 30s, and you can see her all over the world, really. And she is associated with buying things like cosmetics and cigarettes, but also being very interested in romance and often having gone to school. So in Africa, I would say schoolgirls became the first modern girls. And what we saw in doing that research on cosmetics was that skin lighteners were a product that were all over the world in the 1920s and 30s. And they were a product that in the early 20th century were used by white women as well. So in the early 20th century, skin lighteners were some of the most common products that white women used. And what happened then is in the 30s and 40s, when tanning became fashionable for white women, it really became kind of a new form of showing you had white privilege or that you were an elite person, being able to spend time on a beach or outdoors tanning. Then skin lighteners really became a product that was much more just associated with women of color. But that's not, there's an older history where white women use them. And actually today, as Amira knows, there are ways in which white women are coming back again to use products that often aren't called skin lighteners, but actually have the same ingredients. They might be called anti-aging products or skin brighteners. So to me, then that just seemed like a fascinating history. In a way to really try to understand African history and gender and the history of women in Africa through a different lens. And so then I started doing research in South Africa, and South Africa has a really extraordinary, unique history around skin lighteners. And so that's what the book then came to be about. But that's basically how I got interested in the topic. It was something that I saw that I didn't understand. And so I wanted to learn more about it.
That's a really great point on the white women used it. You know, some of them use for skin conditions. You know, like, you know, the other thing is dermatologists do prescribe this as a treatment for skin conditions, but, you know, it's just for short time under supervision of the doctor. But the thing is, what I want to ask more about, Lynn, is that, don't you think that this also started during colonizations, you know, like and how the colonizer, could you talk about in your based on your research, how the colonizer is, you know, like influenced in terms of in the case of South Africa?
Yeah, absolutely. So the history of colonialism in South Africa is really, really long. So the Dutch set up the first colonial outpost in 1652. So, you know, almost 400 years ago now, white European colonizers came to South Africa. And those colonizers brought with them their own beauty ideals and practices. And those evolved over time, but at the core of them was an understanding of beauty that was very much centered on whiteness. And the very, you know, ideas of slavery, colonialism, segregation, and then apartheid, which came, were all based in this idea of there being different races and that there were racial hierarchies. And so the beauty ideals definitely came to be tied to those. So as time went on, then African women. And, you know, in South Africa, because it has such a long history of colonialism, it also has a very kind of complicated demographic history. So in South Africa, under apartheid, you came to have four different racial categories that the government recognized. You had Europeans, whites, the colonizers. Then you had Asians, which could include South Asians and Chinese East Asians who were brought as indentured laborers to South Africa. Then you had basically Black African or Bantu. And then you also had colored as well. And so the people who fell into the category of colored were either mixed race, or oftentimes they were the descendants of Khoisan speaking people who had lived kind of in the western parts of South Africa. So all this is to say South Africa had a very wide spectrum of skin tones, you know, going back actually a couple hundred years and actually even going back further than that. And in this system, so in which it was based basically in white supremacy, was a racialized political system, even really small distinctions in color came to carry a lot of meaning for people. And so in that context, people lighten their skin, and people would use skin lighteners not necessarily to get reclassified. So it wasn't that like colored people, by and large, like if they use skin lighteners, they would think they would get reclassified as white, or color, Africans would get reclassified as colored. But really there was a much more kind of subtle understanding of status within those racial categories, in which skin lightening and just lightening your skin a little bit was seen that it would give you greater status or greater privileges.
Mm-hmm. True, that's absolutely, that's very interesting. So so how about like within groups, like, you know, colorism
it's not also external, you know, groups coming from, but also within groups. Have you seen that in South Africa?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that's, I mean, colorism relates to racism, right? I mean, colorism grows up in situations of racism, but so often the prejudice or the discrimination is happening between people within a group. So the ways in which kind of the bigger, broader racial order then come to influence people. And that's certainly true. So just to give an example, so beauty contests become very popular in South Africa from really the 1930s on. So beauty contests are very popular. And so there were white beauty contests, but there were also beauty contests run by colored organizations or African organizations. And really up until the, I would say the late 1970s, the people who would win those beauty contests, the women who would win the colored contests or the contests sponsored by African organizations, would almost always have lighter skin tones. Yeah. And so you can see, and that those contests were entirely run. They weren't run by white people, but you can see how that beauty ideal had kind of seeped into those communities. So it took really the Black Consciousness Movement of the 1970s. So the Black Consciousness Movement with Steve Biko as the leader to really push back on those kinds of ideas, right? And so an African nationalist in other parts of like East Africa were also doing the same thing to say like, this doesn't make sense. You know, we really have to embrace Black as beautiful. And so, and that also related to things happening in the US. So with the civil rights movement and the Black power movement in the US. So I would say in the 60s and 70s, things really began to change. And, you know, it's also true that there were always people who criticized skin lighteners and the idea that to be attractive, you had to have lighter skin tone. So there have always been Black activists and intellectuals who have criticized it, but I would say the number of people criticizing it really increases in the 70s and the 80s in Africa. And it ends up in South Africa that in 1990, so just a few months actually before Nelson Mandela's release from prison, the apartheid government actually passes the toughest regulations against skin lighteners. And that's really the product of anti-apartheid activists. So that's the, what happened is the Black consciousness activists came together with medical professionals, many of them white medical professionals, dermatologists who were really worried about the bad health effects of mercury and hydroquinone. And together they formed like a coalition or alliance, and they pressured the South African government to, first of all, ban all products, all cosmetics that had mercury or hydroquinone or lead or any of what were the known active ingredients at that time. So they, the government did that. But then the second thing the South African government did, which really no other government in the world has ever done, is that the South African government banned cosmetic manufacturers from claiming that any product could whiten, lighten, or bleach the skin. So in South Africa today, it's illegal for advertisers to make those kind of claims. Okay, so those changes were remarkable. And overnight, it shut down manufacturing of skin lighteners in South Africa in the early 90s. So we're in 2020 now, and things have changed again. There's actually a pretty significant trade in skin lighteners today in South Africa, but it's actually not a legal trade. You know, yeah. Unfortunately, the government's not doing much to enforce these regulations that exist, but it's actually not a legal trade, although you can very easily find all these products in South Africa.
I was just going to ask you, Lynn, about the regulation. You know, governments can have all of these policies that ban all of these toxic ingredients. Look at the United States. United States banned mercury many, many years ago in cosmetics, and there's no active regulatory system in the United States when it comes to skin lighting. Similarly, in these countries that have banned, they're, you know, like also dealing with that issue. So in the case of South Africa, have you seen them taking aggressive enforcement, you know, like to regulate the legislation that they have of banning these ingredients? And I'm glad that they banned hydroquinone. In the US, you know, we're still struggling banning hydroquinone. So how is their enforcement look like?
Yeah, and it's and it was really doctors in South Africa who did the original research on hydroquinone in the 70s and the 80s and really figured out that the way, at least the way people were using it at these dosages, probably a lot of the dosages were higher than 2%, but sometimes 2%. And also it seemed the exposure to the sun, basically ultraviolet radiation, because so much of South Africa around Johannesburg is at a very high elevation. So the radiation from the sun is very strong. Like that combination with hydroquinone was very damaging and produced a condition called exogenous ochronosis, which the dermatologists really saw as an epidemic in the 70s and 80s. It was one of the most common problems that they saw in dermatology clinics. So they saw it as a big problem. In terms of the South African government enforcing the regulations, you know, unfortunately it doesn't enforce them that much. You know, sometimes they will raid shops, but most of the time they don't. So, I mean, people who work in, that area of the government will say that they're understaffed and under resources. You know, they don't have the people power or the money to really look at all the thing cosmetics being imported to the country or going to different shops. But it also seems like there's a fair amount of apathy and, you know, probably also some corruption involved in the whole thing as well, of people not enforcing the regulations. But I really believe strongly that governments have such an important role to play in addressing this problem. And without governments, you know, regulating things and enforcing those regulations, you know, there's not going to be change. So I think, you know, change has to come from two directions. I think change has to come from the government having good regulations. And as you said, in the US, hydroquinone up to 2% is still available, you know, over-the-counter cosmetics. We need good regulations. We need those regulations to be enforced. And then on the other hand, we need like the super important work that you're doing, Amira, which is really to raise consciousness and to raise consciousness on both sides, raise consciousness about the health effects, but also to raise consciousness that everyone's most beautiful skin color is their natural skin color. And I think it's that message, you know, that has to come from so many different directions. I mean, it's not the government who's going to have that message. I mean, so many, that has to come from, you know, popular media and films and radio and what people read. It's, absolutely. That's really a whole world effort. Yeah.
And you're right. Absolutely. It has to be multi-approach and absolutely empowering communities to really understand, you know, the harmful of these practices. Some of the communities, you know, that use this, they don't even know the historical of this, that, you know, like behind of it, like just even, you know, talking to them about their identities and who they are, you know, potentially might influence to empower them and own who they are. So in terms of prevalence in South Africa, did they do any research on prevalence? You know, with the skin lighting practice, it's such a difficult, public health issue to really measure as a prevalence because of people, you know, my height, you know, using it. I don't know if you've seen that lean in South Africa, but the work that we do, we see a lot of people that are hesitant in, you know, disclosing that they use, but then after time, you know, once they get damaged their skin, you know, disclose and say, I use the skin light. So in that case, it's very hard in the US to do a prevalence study because of, you know, like it's very difficult to count, but we know that anecdotally it's a high prevalence. So in South Africa, do they do any type of research like that?
Yeah, one of the foremost researchers in South Africa is a dermatologist named Losa Dlova, and she's based out of Durban. And so she's done a lot of research, and they have done some prevalence studies. So the way they did them was they interviewed people who were coming to outpatient clinics at the hospital generally. So they weren't coming to dermatology clinics. They were just trying to get kind of a general population of people who might be coming for outpatient care at the hospital. And now I'm just trying to remember off my head. I think the percentages they had, it was African women and Indian women that they were looking at the percentage. And I think that it was around 40% for African women and maybe 30% for Indian women. It was, you know, it was significant. They also asked them why they used, and there really were kind of two big categories of why people said they were using them. One was to get rid of specific dark marks. So, you know, places of hyperpigmentation, maybe following a skin infection, or, you know, a pimple or scarring. Mm-hmm. And then people who were saying that they were trying for an overall lightening effect. And, you know, and I would say that those two different reasons, that's there throughout the whole history. You know, people have, I think, always used these products for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's about, you know, using it temporarily to clear, you know, a dark spot. You know, when they were marketed to white women, they were marketed as freckle removers. Yeah. So it really was about like specific spots of pigmentation. But at the same time, there were some white women who used them for overall lightening, which I would say really was a racialized beauty ideal. Mm-hmm. So I think that is something that sometimes complicates the conversation, because I do think people use them for multiple reasons.
Yeah, they do use for multiple absolutely reasons, you know, and dermatologists do prescribe. But also, you know, it's very important to acknowledge, you know, for, you know, the extra layer for individuals of color, you know, wanting to be light because of either their economic well-being or their beauty standard actually, you know, associates with that. You know, I've seen a lot of people that ask me about, you know, tanning, you know, and compare this to tanning, and this, it's absolutely different. You know, tanning is an optional thing, where this is, it's a historical package where, you know, people were forced to look like certain way and use as a result these type of toxic products. And I think, you know, dermatologists do contribute this hugely, because they don't know how to treat, you know, black skin color, you know, as, but you know, like by default, they prescribe these type of skin lighting products. And I have seen one of the dermatologists that we partnered with talk to me about this many times, about, you know, the potential of, you know, medical school, you know, this is starting in medical school to influence their curriculum, but also those dermatologists of color hopefully changing that, you know, like in their practices or in the medical field. So so I agree with you. It's a huge issue that impacting a lot of people. So in the case of
just to give you an example of how different it is from tanning. So in apartheid South Africa, there would be advertisements in newspapers in Cape Town or wherever, where it would be like a white shop owner advertising to hire usually a colored, by that apartheid category, a colored girl. But in the ad, it would actually say, you know, we need a light toned or a pale colored girl. It would actually be specified in the ad. I mean, there's never been an ad written anywhere that I can think of that would have said, like, we're hiring white women, but they have to be tanned. I don't know. And maybe someone for a tanning salon, but yeah. And so today in South Africa, you don't have ads that say that.
Yeah.
But that thinking is still, you know, there in places, right? I mean, you know, not everywhere, but there's certainly the idea that you'll have better success getting a job in a place where unemployment is, you know, really high, or you'll have a better chance of, you know, attracting a boyfriend or a girlfriend, mm-hmm. if you're a little bit lighter. So even though these things aren't like said now explicitly in something like an advertisement, mm-hmm. it still shapes people's thinking.
Actually, it says explicitly in some advertisements, like in India, or mm-hmm. even in some parts of Africa and Latin America. You know, I do interviews on the Latin American communities here in Minnesota, and they always talk about, you know, like their political and power attainment in their countries depends on like their skin shade, you know, how mm-hmm. They are. And they said to this day, that type of advertisement is out there. But the thing is, it goes back to your point, it depends on the government, you know, mm-hmm. what they allow to happen in terms of advertisement, or even if they understand how impactful is, you know, like this whole media and ads.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that conversation with, you know, activists or people working on these issues of racism and colorism in Latin America is such an important conversation for people in the US to have. Because I think sometimes people in the US have thought of it just in kind of black and white terms because of the legal status of the one drop rule and the way that US law defined race.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. Just yesterday, I was reading it on Twitter, the University of California coming up, you know, like with classification of race and ethnicities, and they classified, you know, some African countries like Somalia under white, Northern Africans, like, and Somalia, it's not even in Northern Africa, it's in East Africa. And so, and that is academia setting where they're coming up with this kind of classification. And, you know, like for many, many years, Mexico was classified as, you know, like white category. So these kind of things happen where Latinos are lumped together in one, but Latinos are very diverse groups. You know, they have indigenous, they have, you know, like Afro Latinos and whites as well. And these kind of things, you know, the differences that they have in when they're in their countries impacts them, you know, especially those with darker skin and different hair texture and all of that. So these kind of things impact them a lot. So in the case of South Africa, how is the media doing? Like, do they have a lot of advertisement through the media, or that is just, you know, under, you know, the table, like it doesn't happen so often?
Yeah, there is some advertising through the media. It's kind of erratic. I wouldn't say it's consistent. And, you know, kind of the issue comes up into public awareness more at times than other times. But in the time that I was doing my research over 10 years, I would find articles or advertisements in the newspaper, but they will usually talk about them as like tone, like evening out tone. Mm-hmm. Or they'll basically use other terms. I mean, legally, they're not supposed to be using whitening or bleaching, so they'll use other terms. I would say what's become a big deal in South Africa over the past, you know, 5 or 10 years were celebrities. So South African celebrities, some music celebrities in particular, who were kind of known and well-known in social media, who really embraced using skin lighteners. So things like glutathione infusions.
Yeah.
So kind of new kinds of therapies that really dramatically change people's appearance. Mm-hmm. And so then on social media, they were criticized by people. So there was a lot of discussion about that. And, you know, they would often defend themselves saying, well, I should be able to, you know, do whatever I want to do. But the argument that really comes from kind of the political argument, which I would say in South Africa, you know, goes back to Black consciousness. Those arguments would be made like, you're not, you know, you don't, you're not embracing your natural skin color. What does this say about how you see yourself and other people who are Black? So, yeah. So I would say celebrity culture. And then there's so many different ways. I mean, as anywhere in Somalia or Kenya, there's so many different ways these products are sold, right? They can be sold at really high-end boutiques where you would get those glutathione infusions, or, you know, they're sold at the bus station or taxi rank. And, you know, oftentimes at the low end of the market in South Africa, you know, oftentimes there are immigrants from other parts of the continent, from Central Africa, West Africa, who are involved in that trade. But then you also have shops that are owned by Indian storekeepers, and you might have products coming in from India as well. So the market is incredibly varied. And also in South Africa, there's something called umemezi, which is the bark from specific trees in South Africa. So this would be a botanical lightener that comes from indigenous trees in South Africa that would be sold almost like outdoor, you know, food markets. And so, you know, for 50 cents or for a quarter, you can buy some of that bark that you kind of boil up and it can act as an exfoliant. So there are also kind of non-commercially manufactured things that people use as well. So it's an incredibly diverse market.
And you know, it's so funny. That is, you know, what's happening also in the US, like, you know, like now we have been telling government to go to these ethnic stores, regulate and all of that, you know, that sell, but, you know, all of these toxics, hydroquinone, you know, mercury and lead as well. But the thing is, we are seeing more and more now, and this is through like social media advertisement, Snapchat, where some of these business owners, but particularly women, are making these products in their homes. And then, you know, bringing to the market and saying that, you know, I've been working on this formulation for 3 years and none of them are chemists, you know, or even know anything about health. And so there's that new trend now where they buy more mercury powder from online and then use some of the creams that they have and mix. So they mix multiple products and bring into the market. And then advertise to women.
Yeah, and that kind of mixing of things, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know, in places like Nairobi, but I'm sure in Johannesburg and Cape Town, but I've seen it much more in Nairobi, people mixing all kinds of things together. And then selling them in the market and saying to the customers who come that, you know, they'll mix up a batch that's specifically for them.
I've seen that in Nairobi where they were mixing specifically for women who were getting married 2 weeks after they used the skin lining product. And the way that they explain, it's just, so these kind of markets, that also gets difficult in terms of regulatory. So this is where I think, you know, community organizing and empowering communities to really help communities understand, you know, the impact that this has for them. And so they stop those within the communities who are making business out of them and mixing these products.
It really has to come from both sides because it's very hard to stop people from doing things in their living room or their kitchen. That's very hard.
So in the case of South Africa, in terms of manufacturing skin lighting, do they have, you know, what I'm learning is that there are small, you know, subcontract manufacturers that are getting opened in some parts of Africa. I don't know if South Africa is one of it, but in West Africa, definitely, that manufacture skin lighting products.
Mm-hmm.
So is that the case for South Africa?
Yeah, so before the 1990 regulations, there were huge manufacturers in South Africa, and Twins Products was the biggest one. But when the regulations were passed in 1990, those factories really did shut down. The government really did shut them down. But, you know, within a few years, people started seeing products being sold. Originally, they were being brought in from outside, you know, maybe coming in from like Zambia or, you know, from Central Africa. And so I had thought, you know, that the stuff that was being sold in South Africa was mainly being manufactured elsewhere. But a few years ago, a group of people at the University of Cape Town, so Lester Davids and some other people, they purchased a bunch of the products from shops in Cape Town. And they found like a good chunk of those were actually being manufactured in South Africa. And even some of the ones with mercury were being manufactured within South Africa, which surprised me, but is clearly happening. So I would think it's a similar thing. It's being kind of subcontracted out. So it might be a company that makes other products and then, you know, kind of under the table makes some batches of that as well. But it does seem like in-country manufacturing is back in South Africa. Yeah, and, you know, that it contains mercury is just so worrisome. And I mean, I think, you know, we might have talked about this before, but one of the other things that's so complicated about this market is you can have products that, you know, have mercury in them and that's not listed anywhere on the package. You can also have products that claim to have a hydroquinone or mercury in them and actually don't have it in. It's like you really never know what's in things in so many of these products until you actually have it tested. And I know that's true in West Africa too. A friend of mine did a study in Ghana and Accra, and it was the same thing. Mm-hmm. Until they took the products to the lab, the products that were being sold at the market, the relationship between what was said on the package and what the product was, you know, could be so different.
Yeah, hugely different. I mean, for the products that we have been testing now, you know, we even partner with commercial labs, you know, because the Department of Health, their process of testing has been very slow, but also, you know, these are very high toxic ingredients like mercury that can even damage some of their lab equipments. And so we have been contracting with commercial labs and tested many products, but all the products we tested did not say mercury on the ingredient, and all of them tested, for the most part, tested positive for mercury. And the other thing, Lynn, is that, you know, people can't even read some of these languages, you know, like they're either in, you know, like Chinese language or Arabic, you know, some of these, they're not even written in English on the ingredient. And so people don't even read ingredients. They're just buy, actually they trust, you know, like family members or friends telling them to buy this product because it worked for me. And then they buy it, you know, through word of mouth. And so that's the other thing, you know, as part of the education that we do, we teach them how to read ingredients, not only skin lighting, but even any cosmetics that they buy, how to act, even the shampoos that they use, how to actually read ingredients and what does even some of these chemicals mean. So there's so much literacy issue when it comes to these, but also these companies who are not disclosing all of these ingredients.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. That's true. Yeah. And I think, yeah, the brands, you know, people come to know a brand. They don't even really think about like the ingredients if it's, but they've heard by word of mouth that it's powerful or it's popular or that it works. That's what matters. And they'll try to find that. Yeah.
Yeah. They will do anything to find that. You know, I have seen some people told me that when relative or friends are traveling to Kenya, they ask them to bring some of these, you know, like mixed products because they can't find that here. And so they basically know what they want. And it's not, some of them didn't even try this, but somebody told them that it works and it's good. And so people are always commenting to each other in terms of their skin color, you know, how it's changing. And at the same time, Lynn, their skin is getting damaged, you know, externally. Imagine internally how much exposure, you know, is happening to them. So it's just a very huge, huge issue. So Lynn, what do you think academia, what is the role of academia in this?
I think the role of academia or researchers is, you know, just to, you know, research and, you know, research, when you do proper research, you don't know necessarily the answers you're going to come up with, right? Because it's research is a discovery process. But to, you know, to study it, you know, to make recommendations, you know, where appropriate to work with activists, I think that's the role of researchers. But there's so many different kinds of research, right? I mean, you can have historical research like mine. Mm-hmm. You can have, you know, ethnographic research where you do interviews with people and you try to understand more, you know, why they're using the products with an eye to thinking of like how you might be able to convince them not to. Yeah. But then you can have the medical research on the medical problems that are caused. Mm-hmm. And then you can have really what's chemical research, right? That you're analyzing the products and trying to figure out what's going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think you could have policy research as well to try to figure out, you know, why is it that, say, the FDA in the US hasn't been very active on this issue for a while. So, I mean, I know the work that you're doing with Beauty Well to put pressure on the FDA and the CDC to do more research and to enforce the regulations that do exist, and really to, you know, figure out the situation with hydroquinone, because that the FDA started looking into hydroquinone in the early 1970s to figure out, you know, whether it was carcinogenic, damaging. I mean, that's been going on now for 50 years.
Yeah.
Seems crazy.
And you know, I would love to hear about if you have seen this, because last year when I was doing advocacy through the state legislature here around the skin lighting issue, and this was focusing on mercury in the skin lighting and getting budget from the state legislatures to work on, you know, like this, the whole state, to raise awareness, you know, like on this issue. I had a few dermatologists that contacted me who were really stressful that were advocating against hydroquinone. They didn't want us to, so they assumed, because we had several legislative hearings testimony to talk about this issue. And so one of them, even one of the dermatologists came to the committee hearing. And so that really surprised me and shocked me to the point that dermatologists are normalizing hydroquinone and are against, you know, the banning of hydroquinone. And that bill, we're not even focused on hydroquinone. So I think,
you know, any dermatologist that I've ever met will say they want hydroquinone as a medical tool, right? Mm-hmm. So they want that it's a tool that they would use under prescription, under doctor supervision. Oh, where there seems to be disagreement among the dermatologists is whether it should be allowed in 2% in over-the-counter cosmetics. And what's complicated there is a lot of the dermatologists don't just prescribe medicines, but they also have their own cosmetic beauty products that they sell.
Yes, I have
seen that. That's where it's really the commercial side. Yeah. Any doctor ever talked to would say, in terms of dermatological practice, you know, there are a variety of reasons why you might prescribe for a certain period of time hydroquinone to people, but it has to be under doctor supervision. But the issue is whether it should be in cosmetics. And I think the dermatologists who are probably really sensitive about that are probably people who also are involved in kind of a commercial manufacturer of cosmetics. That would be my guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, that's the thing. And it's very, you know, like, you know, us, we know, because, you know, we work on this issue, we do research on this issue, but the general public might not know that. You know, I have seen some dermatologists that are business owners that, you know, have their own brand of cosmetics, you know, and do sell skin lighting in their practice. And so that's another area that, you know, I became, in terms of our advocacy, became interested in, you know, like to make sure that the government understands this, and that, you know, a lot of these dermatologists cannot, we can't trust them on this issue to address, you know, like, I mean, it's just a dermatologist that's just so fearful as advocating, you know, for raising awareness on mercury exposure in skin light, and being fearful that we're banning. I think that's a problem. The other problem that I see is the lack of, you know, we have talked about this, lack of government, you know, fully involved. It's not only the regulatory, but also the public health systems. And this issue predominantly impacts communities of color. And so, they know, you know, the only thing, you know, they know that it's impact, and the only thing that they do is just send warning that, oh, we found a skin lining product that contained mercury. Here is the warning, and nothing happens. No engagement in communities, or even funding community-based organizations to do this work. So that has been another, you know, layer of inequity to this issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, in the case of mercury, I mean, mercury then is also such an important pollutant or toxin to have in the environment, right? To have just in households. So it goes so much more beyond you know, one person applying it to their skin, but it's really about introducing a, you know, a terrible toxin, yeah, into households of color or communities of color as well. I mean, it really is a, it's an environmental health issue and a personal health issue, I'd say.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Lynn. And so Lynn, one last question. So you have done this amazing research and you're still, do write articles around this issue to raise awareness, and it's such an important awareness that, that you raise on this issue. So what do you think the future of this whole skin lightening thing, both in the marketing, you know, companies that manufacture, but also, you know, the whole thing of combating this in the future?
Yeah, you know, I tend to be an optimist. And so that's how I usually look at the future. But I do think right now, particularly with the Black Lives Matter movement and the way that Black Lives Matter has focused so much attention on all the ways in which racism and also colorism, you know, shape our world, I think is only a, you know, a great thing and a really good thing. And just the fact that the those major manufacturers, so Johnson & Johnson, L'Oreal, Unilever, I know they haven't done much, but I don't think they've ever experienced as much criticism on this issue as they've experienced in the past 4 months. Absolutely. So I think that's really, really important. You know, whether, you know, things will change. Again, I think the change really has to come through a general consciousness raising. And again, really getting people to understand that, yeah, their most beautiful color is their natural skin color. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the government regulations to be there and to be enforced. I really think that's where the future lies in that. But I see, you know, I see with young people today, you know, so much reason for optimism. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the kind of activism we see around Black Lives Matter and just the awareness of these issues, I see it in the students I teach at the University of Washington. You know, mm-hmm. I just think they're aware and their concern about these kinds of issues is just very different than even, you know, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So
you're absolutely right, Lynn. You know, I'm very optimistic and hopeful with the young people. You know, we have Young Women's Wellness and Leadership Initiative. So this cohort is 15 young girls between the ages of 14 and 18, and they're amazing, so smart. And we have this kind of discussions and you know, like the way, you know, they advocate, you know, around these issues, and it's just so amazing. And the way they own their skin color and embrace who they are. So I'm just so glad that these young individuals, you know, what they will do.
That's fantastic, because they're the ones who are going to make the difference for each other, right? They're the ones who are in the best position to, yeah, shape and embrace each other, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful with the Black Lives Matter, you know, movement amplifying this whole, you know, combating colorism work. It's just so amazing, you know, what happened in the last 4 months. Even if these companies are, you know, technically not removing all of it, the awareness is there, you know, and so it's just really great what they have done. So before I let you go, Lynn, do you want to talk about your book, where people can find?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Listening and want to get your book. It's such an amazing, amazing book, and yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, so the book is called Beneath the Surface, and it was published by Duke University Press. And it was also published in South Africa. So the same book was published by Wits University Press in South Africa. So it's available there as well. And yeah, so I think it's about $25. You can, you know, get it on Amazon. You can get it through your, well, no one's really going to bookstores right now, but you can get it online in various ways and through Duke University Press. And then there are also those two pieces I wrote for the conversations. So I don't know if you have a website, you could even just link to those.
Yes, one of it, I think it's on our website, but also when I post on the podcast, I will add all of these links so people have
access
to book the
article. Because the two articles kind of condense the arguments of the books down. So if you don't have time to read the whole book, you can read the articles.
Yeah.
I know everyone's busy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, with this whole pandemic thing. But thank you though, Lynn.
It was such a pleasure, such an honor to be here with you.
Thank you. Take care. Talk to you soon.